Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning on Three Women, Three Ways. We're the show that tackles the news and the events and people's thoughts, and we're all looking at it from three different ways. We agree a lot, but we also disagree somewhat. And by we, I mean myself and co-hosts Deborah and Connie Sue. I'm Heather Stark, and Connie Sue, how about an introduction from you?
Well, certainly. Good morning. It's a lovely, lovely morning here in the Thurston County area of Washington State near our beautiful capital in Olympia. And I go by Pinkley, which is my nickname, which was tacked on after surviving domestic violence. And I am here this morning with renewed energy and thoughts about our current events and what's going on. And it's just a beautiful morning, and I'm glad to be here with you lovely ladies and our listeners. Deborah, how about you?
Good morning. Yeah, I'm glad to be here, too, as well. It's always good to get together with you, too, as friends and sisters and coworkers. And I absolutely love to talk about news through our lens of violence against women. And I come to you from Southwest Washington State. I am a survivor. I have a 20-year career history in anti-violence against women work, and currently work for a state tribal coalition against domestic violence and sexual assault. And we have a rip-roaring set of news bits to talk about, don't we, Heather?
Yes, we do. And I am glad to be here as well, and I'm working on research, and I do all sorts of interesting things academically, and one of the things that I'm working on right now is my dissertation for a PhD. So those are our backgrounds, and one of the things that we love to do, as you mentioned, Deborah, is to talk about things in the news, and there are so many things in the news that affect women and affect violence against women. And, of course, one of the things that we saw this week in the news was a teacher in California. She was a victim of domestic violence, and she went to her school officials and said that she had a protection order from her husband, and she just wanted to inform them about what was going on. And sure enough, her husband came onto the property. He didn't leave the parking lot, but they put the school on lockdown, and then after it was all over, they fired her. And they said and they also kicked her kids out of the school. And it was a private school. I believe it was a religious school. And they just said, you know, sorry, we can't have this. We can't deal with this. And so you're fired. And your kids have to find someplace else because we can't put the other kids in danger. And wow. What's your reaction to that, Deborah?
I'm sitting here boiling. Do you want to go first, Connie Sue?
Well, my first thought was, what century are we living in? I thought that we were much more advanced in supporting victims of domestic violence in the workplace. I am a program director for a local sexual assault and domestic violence agency here in Thurston County, and I was just, I had mixed emotions, one of horror and shock, and then the other of, well, there's still a lot of work to be done, obviously. And so, boy, a combination of emotions. What's happened here is just an atrocity. I heard about that and was I was home and saw that on the news and was just my mind was just boggled in hearing that. And that they would put that on the news, that they fired her. My question would be, what if they didn't fire her and supported her? Would they put that on the news? So what are your thoughts, Heather?
Well, I want to get to Deb because she was chomping at the bit here. I thought.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I thought I'm gonna play devil's advocate, but I'm gonna wait until Deborah has her say.
Okay.
Right.
Well, it makes me angry. I mean, that's who I am, of course. Occasionally, I'm angry, but I think that there is a larger responsibility to society that in the year 2013, we can't have figured out a different response. I understand that the way I read the story, I believe her divorced abuser showed up at school and threatened her, maybe even had a gun. So this is an extreme case of domestic violence. However, the teacher, the woman, has done everything she can. She's divorced him. She left. Society says, why don't you just leave? She left. She got a divorce. She's moved on. She's supporting herself and her two kids. She has done everything in her control. Yet, domestic violence still happens to her. And that alone makes me angry, right? But then you put her in the middle of this. And also from what I've read, and I understand that this is a parochial school or a religious-based school, so they do have a little more leeway as far as being able to let her go, you know, fire her for something that happened to her. And I think it's out-and-out discrimination. I think it's a horrific public service. And I think it just reinforces everything every batterer has said to every victim survivor since time began is that I can get away with it and you're going to pay.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I agree with Connie.
Why couldn't they have found some different response besides firing?
And then put that on the news saying, hey, this is what happened. This is what the response was. And that would be to arrest him, hold him accountable, put the community of her coworkers, her support, you know, get a rally, a support system for this person as opposed to firing her, which now increases even more of her risk for, you know, financial risk. I mean, it just puts her in a whole other category of risk of being hurt and her children by an action that was directly done by her ex-husband. So,
well, I think that I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I also am appalled by the story. I also wish that there could have been something else accomplished and believe that there could be something else for the solution. However, the guy never left the parking lot. Okay, that's my understanding. He never left the parking lot. He didn't invade the school. He went into the parking lot. And based on this whole reaction occurred. He is in jail at this point. The school said that they had no guarantee that how long he would be in jail, and they couldn't put their students at risk. Now, I empathize with them. I think that they're kind of between a rock and a hard place. They do have responsibility for students, and I think that they have an obligation to minimize risk wherever they can. So if this woman being in the school poses a risk, not for herself, but, you know, because of him, don't you think they have an obligation to get rid of her to keep the kids safe?
No. They could have put her on administrative leave. They could have helped protect them, put them in a safe place. She didn't have to be there if that was part of the risk factor. There was administrative leave they could have put her on. They could have just said, or take a leave of absence. Do something that would support her rather than re-traumatize and re-victimize. And that to me is a community response. And I have said from the beginning of my involvement in this work, you know, over umpteen years ago, it's going to take our community to end violence against women.
Yeah.
Not the advocates, not law enforcement. It's going to take all of us. And to me, that is appalling, especially when you think of the professional standards to be a teacher. This was a professional environment. You would think that people were a little more intelligent and educated and informed on how to respond to domestic violence. Hold that person accountable.
And I have another, Heather, you reminded us that he is in jail. So why did they have to fire her immediately?
Well, actually, they did put her on administrative leave for, I believe it was 3 months, 4 months. And then, instead of letting her back, they just sent her the letter saying, can't have you back.
Well, he's still in jail. So my point is, why do they have to punish her while he's in jail and he's under control? I mean, she could have finished out.
Well, because they said they had no guarantee how long he would be in jail.
Which is true.
I thought he was
there
still. Is he not in jail still?
I don't know for right this moment whether he still is, but at the time of the decision, he was. And they addressed that in their letter, and they said that, well, he's currently in jail. They have no guarantee how long he's going to be there.
Right, which is true. They don't. That's not – they have no control over that.
So
– I mean, that's up to the judicial system.
Yeah. I'm going to cough.
But why could not the judicial system, the law enforcement system, the sentencing portion, the probation, parole system, why couldn't they not come together – in a way that would be respectful of that and firing her.
Right, a multidisciplinary sort of response. Wow. So, boy, that got us charged up here, ladies.
Yeah, you know, we usually like to talk a little bit about history, at least I do, and in my pursuit of quotes, I found one by an educator and an author named Rianne Eastler, and her quote says, "For most of recorded history, parental violence against children and men's violence against wives was explicitly or implicitly condoned. Those who had the power to prevent and or punish this violence through religion, law, or custom openly or tacitly approved it. Reason violence against women and children finally out in the open is that activists have brought it to global attention." So that says a lot for us, I think.
Yeah, that's a great quote, Deb.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it interesting that in the same week we're having this discussion about this lady losing her job, the UN, World Health Organization, came out with a report that's rather startling, and it has gotten a lot of press coverage, and that is a report saying that about 40% of all women have experienced violence at the hands of a domestic violence perpetrator. You want to talk a little bit more about that for us, Deborah?
Yeah, the World Health Organization and several other large organizations have come together to disseminate the information from their report. And what's so groundbreaking about it is that it is the first study done on this on a global level. And as we were visiting right before the show started this morning, I think one of the reasons that it has hit the news at the level it is because they're looking at it from the perspective of a health issue. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, health issues both locally and worldwide do get a lot of media attention. So, I mean, not that I'm upset. I'm extremely glad that so many people are making note of this global, document, because maybe it's going to wake some people up that have not been looking or hearing or noticing.
Right.
There's
a quote in
the article that says, "This news data shows that violence against women is extremely common."
No, stop the
press.
Yeah,
that's one of the co-authors of the report. And I was just like, really? Really?
Well, that's
this
all right.
You
have to make it official. It has to be official, okay?
Okay.
Well, I think it's startling, the statistics that they found. I really do. And finally, it's good to have it looked at, as you said, Deborah, on a global scale. Pinkley, what do you think is going to be the outcome of such a report? Do you think anything's going to change?
Well, I think that the people that are, you know, interested in reading those reports might reconsider their thoughts on it. And I think that if you do look at it from a health aspect, I think that would bring more attention. And it does absolutely impacts every part of your body and your brain and your, you know, your spirituality. Everything is impacted. It's not just a physical aspect. And if we look at it from that and take a holistic view around domestic violence, I think that could have a great impact. But I think it's going to take time to have the kind of response consistently. I mean, we know that people have been really well supported and are safe and alive and thriving because of systems, institutions, or agencies responding to domestic violence. I think the medical profession, if they look at that as a way of screening or asking questions, which I know some of the healthcare professionals are going towards, that's an opening. So it's a start. I don't think it's all gloom and doom, but boy, when you hear about a story like what we just talked about in San Diego, it puts you spinning on your head saying, boy, how far have we not come around this issue?
Well, for me, because, Connie, so you said you think it's a start, but for me, in the year 2013, we're just starting? Really? Again, really? I already have a 20-year career history of working against violence against women. And when I joined 20 years ago, we already had 20 or 30 years people prior to us that had been working on violence against women. So that's the part that dumbfounds me.
It's funny you should say that, Deborah,
later.
Well, you tie in with something that I found when I was doing my research yesterday. They are protesting in California about this teacher losing her job. And the photograph that goes along with the story shows one of the protesters holding a sign saying, "I cannot believe I still have to protest this shit."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's been going on for so long, and I think that sign pretty much says it all. Still?
Well, yeah, and Rhianne Eisler reminds us, since recorded history, this has been going on.
Yep.
How long have we known how to write?
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. Well, that's not the story about the teacher is not the only news story that we saw this week. We also saw, oh gosh, there was one story where this is some good news. There was a story where a man was intimidating his wife and the witnesses to his domestic violence charge, and so he was in Hawaii. He's 42 years old. And he was able to get an extended prison sentence because of that, intimidating the witnesses and all that kind of stuff. So, you know.
So that's good news in the media. But also in the media, I found a story that made me almost sick to my stomach. There's been quite a bit of attention recently paid to rape in the military. And they've been having congressional hearings and talking about how to, you know, increase the response in a meaningful way. And a Wall Street Journal journalist named James Taranto published an article that can only be called as sexist hate speech. And he really trivializes that whole effort to end sexual assault in the military. And what his article says is that all this this campaign to end sexual assault in the military is a, quote-unquote, war on men. And he refers to sexual assault in the military as hanky panky. It's only hanky panky and sexual recklessness. It's not anything more than that. And because all of the groups are making such a big deal about it, you know, it's a war on men. How do you respond to that?
Poor men, the poor guys. Why aren't we leaving them alone, Deborah?
And just let them have their sexual
fun. Their fun
shenanigans. Their sexual shenanigans. Have their way.
It's play. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Get a sense of humor, ladies.
Yeah, well, and so my response to this when I first, I of course had to comment on it because thank goodness they allow us to comment on articles now. My response was, if this is only a war on men, how does that explain the extremely high numbers of men being raped in the military? So,
and
you know,
I suppose there was no response to that.
Of course, of course.
And it's I think that we can add to that, too. It's men on men. I mean, women certainly are not going around raping men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not what we're talking about. It's men on men. Men are taking advantage or raping other men. Now, that certainly would be a taboo conversation to even begin.
Certainly the whole thing should be taboo. It should be taboo to rape, period, in the military, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it's hanky-panky.
Well, and the websites that I was looking at, I don't know why I would be, but I was shocked at the responses. I mean, this vitriol from there's a contingent of men out there that are convinced that domestic violence and any news about domestic violence is just an attack on them as a species, if you will, and that they're really that just as many men are abused as women. Nonsense. That women start it most of the time. Nonsense. But just this vitriol, I mean, this absolute hatred that comes across in some of these responses, and I just am dumbfounded by that. I'm just, what do they call it, gobsmacked by that. And yet we see that time and time again.
In our most believed and trusted news sources, you know, Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would think that they would have a sense of responsibility to not allow that kind of hate speech in their publications. Go ahead.
Yeah, another thing that was in the news this week is what's that name? A Kickstarter. Kickstarter, which is a website that allows people to just put out their idea out there and ask for help with funding. There's a guy who's writing a book basically on how to rape girls. Did you guys see that in the news?
No.
I did.
He's gotten like $16,000 from Kickstarter, and what he's doing is saying things in this book like, take charge, you know, immediately go over and put your hand somewhere on her. If she's protesting, then just ignore her and keep going because she really doesn't mean it. If she, you know, pull her into your lap, don't wait to ask permission. Take her somewhere away where you can have privacy. If there's a quiet beach or if the seats in your car fold down, take her there, you know. And basically, it's just a great big huge book on how to rape and molest women. And yet people are kicking in money so you can help write this book.
So the CEO started a campaign to not fund it, or is he saying you can't fund this on our website?
No, the CEO is remaining silent. I mean, what I saw was a request for people to contact the CEO and say, get this off Kickstarter.
Oh,
but
I see.
The CEO of Kickstarter,
I thought I saw where he responded to it, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
Yeah. There should... And, you know, and I read this yesterday. Maybe he's done something since then.
Yeah, I don't know. And wow, yeah,
and
that's
really
terrible.
In this day and age, we're out there helping some jerk who's writing a book basically on how to attack women. Write a book on how to do that.
Well, and crowdsourcing, which is what Kickstarter is supposed to be the newest wave of social media activism fundraising. And so by that kind of
terminology assigned to it, I would assume there would be a consciousness about and a sense of justice about what they're going to put on their websites, what they're going to allow to raise funds.
You would hope so, or they could say it's a freedom of speech. I mean, but you would hope that they would consider that.
These websites are, I guess I was going to say privately owned. I mean, I guess they technically would be, wouldn't they? I mean, they have their own CEOs and all that kind of stuff, so wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, but I still would think that there's an implied sense of social justice and responsibility in the venue that they've been created. And I know, yes, they are a business and they have a business model, but there's also a way to have business that is socially responsible, right?
Well, I was saying when Pinkley said about, well, they have freedom of speech. Well, you know, you have freedom of speech on public air, you know, I mean, but there are constrictions to that, or restrictions rather, and if it's a privately owned site by some company, then freedom of speech doesn't apply to that.
Well, and I think that's what Deb's saying. You'd think that they would have, I would call it a moral obligation, you know, an ethical and professional obligation not to allow things like that on their site, but isn't it... I mean, I've seen the petitions going around about Craigslist. I mean, they have human trafficking on there, or other sites that are general public where they sell, you know, tires for Pete's sakes, or junk, or, you know, whatever.
There are personal ads for placed there by traffickers to earn money off the people they've trafficked. Yeah. You know, speaking of trafficking, there was another big report that was released in the media, and it was released on June 19th, and it's released by the U.S. Department of State. It's called Trafficking in Persons Report 2013, and it's actually our Secretary Kerry was there to help unveil it and re-establish our President Obama's focus on the issue, because this is not only a global and international issue, but it happens here in the United States. And this report is so big, I placed the website on our Facebook page because they have a PDF format, and they've broken it into 7 different documents because there's so much information.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's. I haven't had a chance to read it. I've downloaded the summary, and the front pages are, Secretary Kerry saying how important this is to us and that we need to pay attention. So I think that's pretty... It's a 66-page summary, so maybe we'll talk about that in a future show, right?
Yeah, I have a friend who's doing a PhD dissertation on trafficking, and I was shocked, you know, just talking with her, that the police response to trafficking of young girls is to just basically bust them for prostitution or put them in jail. And there doesn't seem to be a big connect in most police departments that many of these young girls are being turned out because they've been trafficked. They're from,
they're basically somebody's slaves. I think part of it might be, Heather, and this is certainly by no means an excuse, but and this is just a personal observation or thought around it, is that they don't have systems in place to handle it, or they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So it's far easier to just say, okay, I'm going to arrest you, and knowing that at least they're taking them out of that environment. But we know that that's wrong on so many different levels. But it's in our backyards, and we as a society are not prepared for that. It's been referred to as modern-day slavery. And my goodness, are we prepared to deal with that? I don't think so as a society. We're not. We can hardly handle, you know, domestic violence and sexual assault, let alone people being enslaved into human trafficking. I mean, you think of that as just, you know, that's going to happen somewhere else in a in a country where there's poverty and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But, no, it's happening right now up and down I-5. Right now in our backyard.
Yeah.
In fact, the trucking industry is a big purveyor of it because they can pick up a young, innocent human being in one state and, you know, in a couple hours be in another state, and it's so hard to find them. Well, but
right.
One of the common responses of a police department to a younger person who's missing and a parent reports it is, oh, they're a runaway.
Right. You know, oh, yeah.
They're a teenager. They're just being, you know, they're just doing what teenagers do. And they use that as an excuse not to look into it, I feel. Because,
well, and what,
like,
if they're not? What if the person's not a teenager?
They feel like they don't have the responses or the resources. But it's not okay when a teenager is missing and a parent reports it, because parents are mandatory, you know, we're mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. And so if you have a parent reporting that, shouldn't our systems be able to respond to that in a meaningful way other than say, oh, well, she or he is just a runaway? I mean, I don't know. I don't get it. There's a huge disconnect between a lot of systems and what is really going on in the lives of human beings these days.
Well, and I think some of it, as you pointed out, Pinkley, it's so overwhelming. I mean, when we were doing our research for the show, I mean, goodness gracious, the number of news stories just for one day about domestic violence. Astounding. Absolutely astounding. And we
what article were you going to chat about that happened close to home?
I think what really caught my attention on the news about a story I heard was that the current girlfriend is basically, I thought it was a law enforcement involved, but it's not. His wife went missing. He's the only suspect in the murder of the case. And all I could tell or think about is, here is his next victim living with him, saying that, yes, absolutely, I have suspicion. But, you know, we all snap once in a while, and we all, you know, do things that maybe we shouldn't do. And
I'm sorry, murder is not snapping.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just felt such a great sense of outrage at the same time, real empathy for this woman, because this is his next victim, and she's so caught up by the charm. They were actually, one of the neighbors called the police because they heard screaming. And what it was is they were having sex out in the front yard. I mean,
she screams when she has sex?
Well, apparently so. They arrested this guy, and for suspicion, he's the only suspect in the murder of his wife. It was in Bothell, Washington. But he's also asking now for the public to help, to donate money to get him out of jail.
Oh, my God.
Of course.
In this woman that he's now with on the news, I was looking at them, he's sitting there innocently looking like, you know, wow, how could I couldn't possibly have done this, with his new girlfriend's arm around him. And it just got the hairs on my back. I thought, oh, my gosh, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into with this person. You know, and another news story I saw was, this was in Bellevue, this is up north of Seattle, Washington. An ex-husband stabbed his ex-wife 72 times.
Oh!
No times is enough, but can you imagine the rage? 72 times.
Did he kill her? Did
yes.
she survive
oh, yes.
that?
No.
No.
Oh, no. A neighbor found her. No.
And I bet
and
he just...
he was. Yeah, he must have just snapped. And so he was, of course, trying
well, you know,
to make
it's his... the economy. It's the economy, I think.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, he was
either that or was
to...
he drinking?
You know, I don't know, Heather, but I know that the story also indicated that he was on his way down to Mexico, so that maybe the economy would be better down there.
Oh, sure, because the economy in Mexico is so much better.
Yeah. With $5,000 they found in the trunk of his car. It's 72 times. I mean, anyway, those were the most couple recent stories that I had seen on our local news, and of course... when you're sitting in your living room and after working all day in a domestic violence agency and you come home and listen to that, I have a tendency to either have one of two responses, sometimes both. I numb out or I become so enraged, I don't know what to do with myself. I mean, I don't know what to do with those kind of reactions that we're still hearing and seeing that women are being brutally murdered by someone who professed to love them.
Yeah.
It's like, when and where does this end?
Yeah.
It doesn't end. It just doesn't end. And it won't end until we have some serious social and cultural change. I mean, I did some looking around on the global side of this topic, violence against women, and I found two articles that were really pretty crazy-making for me. In Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Sharia law has convicted two women's rights activists of the crime of takdib, which is incitement of a wife to defy the authority of her husband. They were charged because they supported a Canadian woman and her children who had allegedly been abused by the woman's Saudi husband. So the tribunal absolved them of the charge of trying to help them escape. But they have been convicted of supporting a wife without her husband's knowledge, undermining the marriage.
And they say what the punishment for that is?
10 months in prison and banning them from leaving their country for 2 years.
Oh, my God. So, in other words, you can't even try to help a woman who's being abused in that situation.
No. No. It's against their religious, because really Sharia is their religious law, or you might say customary law. And in Saudi Arabia, they're trying, I think they have statutory law, and then they also have Sharia law.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pretty deep, right? That just think, Connie Sue, you and I would have been in jail about 100 million times.
Yeah. They would just have a wing for you
thrown
two.
Away the key.
Yeah, no, I think they would have just left us there. We'd still be there.
Yeah. We probably would be branded or strung by our thumbs or something. I don't know. I'm being facetious, but it's just obnoxious to me that in this day and age that happens. And so there is an organization called Equality Now that has written up a petition, and they're going to try to follow up and get the two advocates released, which, of course, I signed. And I will put that information on our Facebook page as well. So, and
right.
I was just... The second article that drew my attention was an absolutely horrific crime where a woman was burned, and her family and neighbors called the police together and asked them to do an inquiry because the woman's husband and mother-in-law and sister-in-law said she tried to commit suicide by burning herself.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And she had burns on herself. 85% of her body was burned. And
oh my
the family did get to the hospital, but they claimed it was suicide. So the problem, the real problem for the family came is the poor woman died. And so they did an autopsy, and the post-mortem examination revealed that the victim had been beaten up and her hands tied before she was set on fire.
Oh.
So that's a little bit tough to think about, too, you know, that they could have gotten away with that except for the woman's family and the neighbors. The neighbors said, oh, yeah, he beats her all the time, and they've called, and nothing's ever been done. But they actually threw kerosene oil on her. The husband and his sister threw kerosene oil on her, set her on fire in a locked room that was locked from the outside. They then put a gas cylinder in front of the room to make it look like a fire accident. However, that cylinder exploded, and both the husband and the sister were burned. They had like 20% burns all over their body. But they will be, I think they've been arrested. I think the article says they've been arrested. And here's another sad part. She has 4 children, all under the age of. So,
which he'll probably get custody of.
This is in
of
Pakistan.
Course. You know,
yeah.
But, there was a man in my community a few years ago. They didn't the news about the incident didn't include anything about domestic violence, but I have my suspicions. And he got apparently had an argument with his wife in the garage. He picked up an anvil and bashed in her head, and then he put her body in the trunk of the car. And for 3 days, apparently until it became obvious that there was a body in the trunk, he drove his kids back and forth to school and to soccer practice and everything. And then when he couldn't figure out how to hide it anymore, he just drove the car and went to the police station and turned himself in. But he told his kids, you know, that no, mom just went to the, you know, for a vacation or something. And darned if he didn't get, he spends time in jail. I think it was miserably little time. It was like 10 years. And then during that 10 years, he had co-custody of his children. He couldn't have physical custody, but he had to be consulted about doctor's visits and athletic events and, you know, all that kind of stuff. For anybody who's been through a custody divorce knows that this can happen. Both parents get a say in what's going on. And from prison, I think it was his in-laws that had the kids, and from prison they would have to contact him if they wanted to take him to the doctor or the dentist or whatever. Absolutely ridiculous.
That's crazy, baloney. Oh, my God, that's
well,
horrible.
That's still part of the control issue.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here is the power and control over.
And also is that fathers have a right to their child even if they're in jail, right?
Mm-hmm.
For committing a crime such as murdering the children's mother. So I found another quote, Denise Brown, who's the sister of Nicole Brown Simpson, who was murdered by O.J. Simpson, who was a esteemed athlete in the past until this all came about. But here's what she says. Nobody believes that domestic violence kills, and nobody believes it is detrimental to children. This world has got to wake up. To me, if there is domestic violence, if the children see it or hear it, that to me is detrimental. Batterers should not have rights to children. That's Denise Brown's opinion.
Yeah, and that happened in the mid-90s.
Oh, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that was a huge deal here in the United States. It was like one of the first TV filmed involved not only the murder, because they chased him right on the freeway, and we watched that, and then also his trial was televised, which was probably the first time I ever remember that happening.
Yeah. Well, and when you said he killed her, technically we're supposed to say he allegedly killed her, because he was not found guilty of that. So
yeah, because the glove didn't fit, right?
Yeah. Anybody who's ever had leather get wet knows knows that it doesn't go to the back to the same size it was. But one of the stories that I found this week also was kind of interesting because a University of Missouri researcher says that survivors of domestic violence are not getting mental health care. And his study involved victims of violence brought on by intimate partners, and he found that more than 70% of them did not receive any mental health care. They did see a primary care physician, but didn't get any health care, or mental health care, or psychological health care. And 54% of them suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as clinical depression. And, you know, that's astounding to me. It's astounding to me in this day when supposedly we're working very hard to come up with healthcare plans so that people can get what they need, that 70% of the women who actually experienced domestic violence didn't receive any mental health care at all, no psychological care.
Well, part of that is because, I mean, I personally don't believe that domestic violence is a mental health disorder. And so,
I don't think it's a disorder, but I think it's a condition. I mean, when people go through grief, that's not a disorder, but they require some sort of mental health counseling or bereavement counseling, or you know.
But the point I'm trying to make, Heather, is that most survivors or victims of domestic violence, if they're separated from their significant other, they won't have medical coverage. If you don't have medical coverage, you probably don't have a physician that you can go to and that knows you and can really help you make that call. And I think you need to remember that most of us don't really identify it as domestic violence even until it's been going on for a long time. So there's a lot of reasons. But then on top of that now, here, especially in our home state, Washington State, where our legislators are battling to get a balanced budget, mental health services are the first thing on the block. They're the first things cut. And so that impacts not only primary victim survivors, but secondary, such as children, and tertiary, such as family. Because in my opinion, domestic violence or violence against women impacts every single human being on the planet.
I think you're right. I think you're right. It just astounds me, the lingering impact of domestic violence as well.
And I think that that's probably on the person's point. And I get a little bit. I'm going to take just a little different view on that. I think that having support is incredibly important, but when we start identifying mental health support or mental health with domestic violence, I think that that increases a person's perception about there's something wrong with her. You know,
but I also know that a high percentage of domestic violence survivors suffer from PTSD.
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue with that. I just think that it's to be cautious for when we start talking about mental health and domestic violence, because I think people can jump easily to the conclusion when you're talking mental health that there's something wrong with her. I think I would rather have it framed in a holistic approach. I mean, it's just not, depression. I mean, depression is awful. I've suffered with it. And, you know, particularly it's mostly related to my experience with domestic violence.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's a holistic approach of supporting a person. If you don't have money to pay your bills, that causes depression too.
Sure.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? Which could be directly correlated to the domestic violence situation.
PTSD is an issue that I think, you know, that's not something you can control, and it's not something that you can say, it's not something that's your fault, but it certainly is a mental health issue.
It's
what you guys are saying, but I also because I didn't see it that way. I didn't see it as victim, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Blaming.
But for our listeners, and it's a resource that's limited. I mean, people who have the need for mental health resources, period, are very limited.
Still a great deal of prejudice against any kind of mental health issue.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, I work with service dogs for PTSD, and I am astounded by some of the traditionally supportive service dog organizations that everyone thinks is very, very good for service dogs. Well, they are for physical disabilities, but they have a great deal of prejudice against what the ADA calls psychiatric service dogs. And that's a service dog for PTSD is a psychiatric service dog. And I've had people from some of these very well-known organization that supports service animals. And I've been told, well, we just don't think that people who have mental illness should be entrusted with a dog.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that tells me that you really don't have any understanding
about,
you know, some of these conditions. And because I don't think anybody would call PTSD a mental illness. It's a condition, you know, that affects, you know, your cognition and your behavior and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's a direct reaction to something that happened to them out of trauma.
Exactly.
You know,
so
I
see what you're saying about being cautious in that area.
Yeah, I just want to point out that Connie was talking about you can be depressed when you can't pay your bills. And my doctor told me that, and I really believed it was true for me in my case, so I'm speaking from personal, not academia or anything else, but my depression was situational.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
It was situational. And once I got to the point where I was able to meet my own basic needs and my children's basic needs, that depression went away. Now, I have also experienced depression that was some sort of chemical or hormonal imbalance and have had to take medicines for that. So I see it both ways. I mean, you can be depressed, but it doesn't always mean it's a medical condition. Is it your external environmental kinds of factors that is creating that? So, and definitely, violence against women is going to impact both sides of that coin, in my opinion.
Well, yeah,
for sure.
Because you're trying to, you know, not only have you gone through something horrific, your children have too. You know, I don't think anybody who has any experience whatsoever will say that children are not impacted by domestic violence, whether they've been abused themselves or not. So not only have you gone through something horrific that impacts you, you've also gone through the economic upheaval. You're probably dealing with a divorce. You're probably dealing with a police response. You're trying to find social service agencies that might, or relatives or friends who might help you. I mean, you have tremendous stress going on. And people who study stress will say that the most stressful things you can do is to lose someone, you know, through death, or buy a house or go through a divorce, that those are extremely stressful things for a person to cope with. And when you're experiencing domestic violence, you're experiencing, you know, you're getting some of that stuff triple
shot. Yeah, those things could be co-occurring, and you know, it's a loss. You know, certainly when you're experiencing domestic violence or have gone through that, I don't think that people generally have the sense of understanding that it is a loss. It's a loss of a relationship. It's a loss of trust. It's a loss of many, many things. A loss of what?
Dreams, you know.
Dreams, uh-huh.
And plans,
you know,
what
you thought that your life was going to be. And so now all of a sudden you're faced with not only trying to be safe, whether that's physically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, all of those things, but you have to think of now what's next. And, you know, that's a lot to go through, obviously.
Yeah.
It's too much sometimes.
Too much,
yes.
Too much for some folks.
Yeah. I mean, I've encountered people in my life who are upset because, you know, they have a car that's a lemon, and they have to keep dealing with that, and they find it so stressful, and so just, you know, and I think that, just that, that's what you have to deal with, and, you know, that's it, Okay.
So a person that has been, who has experienced a lot of trauma in their life can have a different perspective on other events that people are experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
like, wow, I wish that that was the only thing that I had to experience in life that wasn't working for me.
Yeah, I know. I remember getting a mammogram last year, and the woman goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, I know it hurts." And I went, "Really? You know, if this is the worst I ever have to go through, hey, yippee skippy."
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we were talking a little bit about the impact of dealing with the economic situation, which I don't think we can minimize that. I mean, economics play a huge part in our lives. If we don't have the money to feed our kids or to get them what they need, that's huge. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of this WHO report also mentioned that researchers in South Africa experimented, and they gave small loans, micro loans, to women so that they can start doing their own vegetable gardens and you know, become a seller of vegetables or just something that would give them a chance economically to build their own businesses, you know, either tailoring.
Well, if you're not able to meet your basic human needs,
yeah.
You know, a person can obviously be traumatized and end up having some pretty dire consequences to that.
Yeah. Well,
and
I think what's interesting about this report is that in South Africa, for 2 years, they gave these little microloans out and helped women start their own businesses, mm-hmm. and they found abuse among those women decreased by more than half.
That's incredible.
So
that
economic security, that economic capability, does a lot to help minimize abuse against women.
Mm-hmm.
When
Along
you don't have to rely on another human being for your housing and your food,
mm-hmm.
then you can take your own power back. I totally get that and believe in it 100%. I stayed for 17 years, and there was two reasons, my kids and because of the money.
Yep. If you leave, where are you going to get health insurance? How are you going to take your kids to school? How are you going to support your kids? I mean, huge, huge economic issues that I believe keep a lot of women in those kinds of situations. As a matter of fact, I ran across a couple of different stories this week about women who clearly were abused, you know, and then they recanted. They came back and told police that, you know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. This was nothing. And my first reaction to that was, why would you say that? Here's your chance for some help. And then I thought, of course, they're dependent on that man. If they cut him off at the knees, they've just cut themselves off at the knees.
Yeah, and it's not, yeah. It's a twisted view of life when you live with a perpetrator of violence.
Yep.
I mean, you start believing all the things they tell you.
About how you're not capable.
You know, and it kind of overrides the things you used to know to be true.
Yep.
Well,
it
absolutely, I believe, makes a person incapacitated to survive, to live and thrive on their own intuition, on their own ability to reason. A person's ability to make concrete decisions. I mean, it's such, I've really been thinking a lot about this lately, about intuition and our inner voice and our inner safety net. You know, people poop kind of, you know, really minimize that. But there are so many things that we do in our lives on a daily basis from that inner intuition or voice that's telling us to make decisions about how to move forward next, and you're basically just unable to do that. That goes away. That person has completely taken control over that individual ability to make decisions.
Yep.
And on that note, Deborah, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. Another a well-known feminist from the 70s, Charlotte Bunch, is our closer tonight, or today, this morning, whatever. And she says, sexual, racial, gender violence, and other forms of discrimination and violence in a culture cannot be eliminated without changing culture. And I say amen to that, Charlotte.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. We've had a great discussion today. Please join us next week. We are
Three Women.
Three Ways.
Three Divas.
All righty. Goodbye.